about South Africa and Namibia. And I'm talking about it because I went on a trip. You know, I went on one of these global education trips, Center for Global Education at Oxford College. I spent 3 weeks in February there this year. I'm on sabbatical from my regular job. And I just found it to be a profoundly moving and wonderful experience. And there were 10 of us on the trip. Tom Witt was the leader. And I found the people of South Africa and Namibia to be extraordinarily open and sharing and giving and incredibly willing to accept us. I'm from Chicago, and I was amazed that in an apartheid, maybe it's because it's an apartheid country, but in an apartheid country, there seemed to be almost an easier black-white bridge building going on than there is in Chicago, where it's apartheid sort of de facto, but we don't call it that. Chicago is extremely segregated. But I was it just knocked my socks off. I was totally in anguish and totally in bliss the whole time. It was so energizing, and it was so almost terrifying in the sort of horrible parts of it. South Africa is, as you are all, I'm sure, extremely well aware, moving toward independence. We hope they'll have free and independent elections sometime this year. Sometime they hope they'll have it by, say, next spring. They're actually hoping it would happen within a year when we were there. And Namibia was just coming up on its third anniversary celebration of independence, of being out of apartheid. So Namibia had 2 years and 9 months of experience being out of apartheid when we were there and trying to forge a new nation. And the focus of our trip was really on apartheid, trying to figure out what it was, both pre and post liberation, and on women's organizations in both countries. So it was very interesting to see the two different countries and think about apartheid as something that one has to try to recover from. And they kept pointing out that we're still in this country trying to recover from it, and we're not doing a very good job. So they, you know, are asking us to give them advice, but also expect it to take a long time. I think I'll start showing you some slides and tell stories about the slides. We got there, and for the first 3 nights we stayed in Soweto. The townships in South Africa are not on the maps, just the towns, and the towns are all white and the townships are all black. Soweto is a township. It has 5 million people in it, and it's not on maps. I mean, it's bigger than Chicago, and it's not on the maps because it's black. It's outside Johannesburg, which is much smaller than it is. This is Morris Isaacson School. It was our first morning. We spent the night in a hotel, I mean in the church place that we were staying in Soweto, and then we went to Morris Isaacson School, which is the school that, if you've seen Serafina, it's a school that, what's her name, that actress?
Whoopi Goldberg.
Is in the first scenes of Serafina. It's a school where the sort of current independence movement began. The kids there decided that they just wouldn't study in Afrikaans language anymore and started a rebellion there and walked out of school. And then 90 some of them were killed by the army, and the kids just said, nevertheless, we will not study another day with Afrikaans language, the language of the oppressors. So this is where the rebellion, the current active rebellion has its roots, is at Morris Isaacson School. So it was a very interesting place to visit. There are 1,300 students there, and there are 40, I think in this school there are 40 teachers, some of them part-time. So most
many, we went to other schools where there were 1,300 or 1,500 students and 15 teachers. And I can't remember for sure if this is one of the 15s or one of the 40s. But many classrooms that we walked by had no teacher in them. But every classroom had order and quiet, and the children were at work at their desks. And when we walked in, all these visitors from North America, they would scramble to their feet and look expectantly at us and wait for us to say something. The classrooms are on a corridor, as you can see. There are none of them. There's no inside hallways. The children all, that's how they deal with their garbage. That's a, they burn all the garbage because there's no other way to do it. There's no garbage pickup. The government doesn't provide it. So in front of every or institution, there's a fire going all the time, basically, and that's the Morris Isaacson School fire. The kids are all in uniform. We would say good morning to them, and then they would say good morning, and then we would say, ask them a few questions, and they would answer, and then they would ask us questions, and we would answer, and then they would ask us if we would like to sing for them. You know, 10 of us, one lawyer, two doctors, three professors, all of us having just met a day or two before. So we would say, no, but would they like to sing for us? And then they would sing for us, so that was always fun. That's how the windows looked in the school. And there were bullet holes all over. And the bullet holes were from the police who drive by and shoot still just randomly into the school every day because they don't like the school and they're mad at the people for being ANC and for being rebellious. And the kids are fabulous. The boys sit on one side, the girls on the other. They were so energetic. They were so bright. They knew so much about Clinton's cabinet. They were asking us questions about Clinton's Africa policy. These fifth graders, I mean, you know, it knocked my socks off. It was amazing.
So this is a different school than the first one.
No, this is all Morris Isaacson. So, as you can see, the school is in somewhat not well cared for, but it's an interesting place. A lot of the ceilings are like that. The school has near it hostels, which are these places where men are sort of warehoused and removed from their families and warehoused and put to work in menial labor in cities. And the hostels are the places where the white army seems to feel have the most success organizing black-on-black violence. So they will arm hostels with lots of AK-47s and then pay the guys in the hostels to do violence. And so that there's hostels near this school which regularly come to the school and just destroy whatever they can destroy. And then the newspapers in the United States say, well, it's black and black violence, you know. It's pretty. There are all ages of kids in one level, which I think is because of the war. The kids get derailed out of school real easily. So the boy in the sweater, young man in the sweater, is in the same level as much younger people, but we saw a lot of that in those schools. One of the things that the men in the hostels do when they invade a school sometimes is rape, and the kids in the school hate it and were very articulate talking to us about it and feel that that's one of the worst aspects of one of the worst fears in their life. Now they fear that more than they fear the cops driving by shooting, although kids get killed in this school all the time. They do try to keep out the vandals, but they don't have a lot of success. The sort of slogan, open the doors of learning and culture, is one that you see in graffiti all over in townships. And it's one that's part of their sort of People's Declaration of Independence that they have, trying to work out in a systematic way what they believe they're fighting for. And the kids seem to think that it's very important. They talk about the difficulty of studying because the kids will tell us you can't study at night because there's no electricity, so you have to study when it's light out. And in the winter, that's hard because there isn't a lot of light. But then they say there's also, if you are known to be a studier, then you're likely to get a visit from the police or the army and be killed or maimed or something. So they understand that acquiring an education is a radical thing to do. You know, it was pretty heartbreaking to see them persisting on this question of why they were being raped. This was their library. As soon as the hostiles come and destroy some part of their school, like their library was destroyed, their science lab, the principal's office, the principal keeps all of his files in the trunk of his car. He opened the trunk of his car and showed us, these are all the files from the school, everybody's records, everything. But as soon as the library had been destroyed by the hostiles, then the neighbors come and everybody's desperate for building materials to find shelter. So then all the bricks will be taken from that part of the school and it'll be made into people's shelter. So the school felt very vulnerable to us. This was the principal's office. Whoops, sorry. Then we went from there to a nearby squatter community, the Deep Loop squatter community, still in Soweto. And this, we were told, was one of the best organized squatter communities, at least in the vicinity of Johannesburg. They have a civic association, and the civic associations throughout South Africa are the black people's independent form of government. This squatter community elected not to have anything to do with the white power structure. So they elected officials through their civic association as their governmental structure, which means that when they have a murder here, they don't let the government know, the white government. When they have a birth or a death, it isn't recorded anywhere except among them or in their memory. They just don't call on the whites for anything because they want to completely buy out of that whole white system because it's so bad for them. They don't have running water, but they do have a tap every block or so that they can carry a bucket to and get water. And ringing around the outside of many things, places like this, including this one, there are some porta potties plunked down, and I guess the government expects people to use those. But then within them, there will be like black plastic garbage bags strung around sticks, waist high, in a pit dug, presumably, although I didn't investigate real closely, I have to say. And that will serve as a bathroom for a couple of homes or three or four homes within a squatter community. This one we walked through with their elected head, and he made us stay within 15 feet of him, but he knew everybody, and everybody knew him. And he would introduce us to each person that came along, and then that person would tell us a little of their story. One of the evidences that this is a well-organized squatter community is the fact that they painted numbers on all their doors, which means they can find one another numerically. It imposes some level of order in their lives. Also that the sort of paths and streets were fairly straight, so you could actually see a ways into it. This is the elected official and his wife. This is the head of it. And Mr. Robbie and his wife told me that the clothes were given to him by a church when he was elected so that he would look official, mm-hmm. and that every night she washes and starches his white shirt so that he will walk around the community looking appropriately well-dressed, which he certainly did. And they were very sweet people. That's their home that they're standing in front of. And he was very committed to that community in a very deep way, I felt. That man and woman inside and man run that bread shop. There was a lot of, I was interested in how they make money and how they get food and the informal economy of the squatter community. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of people living here. And I just thought it was so interesting that none of them had any official form of income. I couldn't see any way that they were surviving. I couldn't see any way they were getting food. This man talked to us and sang us a song. He lives there, under, sort of right there where he is. And he spoke English. I mean, as was our experience throughout South Africa, the black South Africans spoke English, Afrikaans, and three tribal languages. They all seemed to have at least five languages at their disposal. The white South Africans had two. They had English and Afrikaans, and a few of them had one tribal language. But this man, you know, is at least bilingual, probably tri or more. So that, oh, sorry. There's another evidence of their informal economy. You know, somebody had that, that was her store, and she sold stuff there. We came to a place where Mr. Robbie told us that there had been a murder, and he was advised by the community. Everybody knew who had murdered this man, and so the accused was brought to Mr. Robbie, and the community advised him to put this man to death because it had been a bad blood between them. It was a senseless murder. Mr. Robbie thought about it, and instead, he has an interesting sentence on the murderer. He stood, while he was telling us the story, there were maybe 30 people from the community standing around us outside our circle, nodding and talking to each other and agreeing with what he was saying and kibitzing. It was quite fun to hear them kind of rehashing this event. But it had been just a few months before. Mr. Robbie said that instead he sentenced the murderer to paying for the funeral of the man whom he had murdered and to bring food every week to that man's family. And he said, if I had not made him that sentence, I would have had to find a way to pay for two funerals and to bring food to two families. So I thought, well, this guy was elected for good reason for his position. He knows what he's doing. We went then to this church and met with this group of youths. It was the Nzandi Youth Choir. I have a tape of theirs that it'd be fun to play if I could. They are incredibly good singers. I mean, they sang everything in complex harmonies and, you know, difficult rhythms, and they were just really good. And then we broke down and met with them in groups of 5, 6, 7, something like that, each of us. So I had my little group that I met with, which are these folks, one young woman and all the rest men. And we spent two hours arguing about women's liberation. And the woman and I, you know, against the boys. And the boys were horrified to hear that my husband takes care of children and does dishes and all this stuff. But he's white, he's an American, white, you know. We had a really good, lively, principled discussion. I found out later two of these boys are murderers. I mean, have killed people, lots of people, because they're part of the war, part of the fighting. Later I learned from the girl all sorts of stories about them, and I found that this is regular for teenagers there because they're all living such a horrendous life. They're involved in such high-stakes battles. So these, what I thought were darling kids, and who were deep people of faith, who were regular, active members of the youth group in this church, are forced into behavior that's just obscene and unheard of because they feel that they're part of this battle for liberation of their people. So it was a very revealing time to me because I have teenagers of my own, and so I felt, you know, connected somehow to them. I'm going to skip that. Now we are a day or two later at a hospital in Alexandria Township. Alexandria Township is one of the townships that is headlined the most these days in our press for the violence there. This hospital is surrounded by hostels, so that the people in the hospital think that less than half of the people coming to the hospital for aid make it there, because so many of them are killed or raped on the way to the hospital because of the violence in this place. The hospital was originally built for white folks, and then they built themselves a new hospital and gave this to the blacks. So it's an incredibly beautiful place, and it was run extremely progressively. That man that's talking to us in the striped shirt there and there was imprisoned for nearly 20 years and tortured, you know, in the extreme. Was released at the same time Mandela was, when they did quite a few releases. He's a doctor, and he said the way he is recovering from his torture, he's very kind of dry, matter-of-fact tone, is to work, saving other people, work hard. So he just, you know, does that and elects not to think about those years of imprisonment. But he works in this beautiful hospital. All the walls have instructional murals on them, inside, everywhere you turn. They didn't depend on your having any particular language, most of them. But they were teaching you constantly how to do things. Like this was in the labor delivery and baby area of the hospital. They had lots of pictures about what's appropriate to do and what's not appropriate, and how big your kid, when should you be alarmed when your kid isn't growing, and what to do about diarrhea. And this was the matron of the labor and delivery, and she said that they have developed a system that works very well in place of using medicine, which of course is hard to come by, for labor and delivery, which is that they either want the delivering woman to bring her family to help her labor, or they appoint community mothers to be the assistant for labor and delivery if the family is dead or not available. And she said that labor and delivery goes much faster and easier, we have healthier outcomes, we don't have problems, which is of course exactly what the research on labor and delivery will tell you if you read it, that it's much better to have loved ones saying encouraging things than to rely on drugs. And since they don't have access to drugs, it's good they know that. But she was such a neat lady, and she was so enthusiastic about the work that she was doing there. They have that vehicle which they can go and fetch to do a safety in and out of the hospital run. They can fetch people if they know that they're needed, but of course no one has a telephone, so that's not an easy thing to do. That's Tom Witt, our guide, that's more of the hospital. Then we left there and drove to the Indian Ocean, to the coast, and this was on the way, just by way of telling you that South Africa was surprised my eyes continuously. It was so beautiful and so varied, and I had no idea, I guess I didn't know what to expect, but I was just, somehow the light in South Africa seemed so wonderful. Everything we looked at looked beautiful. We got to a place where there was the property had been given, a tribal people had been removed from their property and forced into a township, and then it was being given back to them by the courts. And that happened, we went to several places like that. That seems to be a trend now. There seems to be more and more of the illegal removals of people from their land are starting to be reversed. So this was one of those places where that was true. This place was an ANC community, and it was surrounded by Inkatha Freedom Party communities. So there was a lot of tension between the two different communities. There were a bunch of Catholic nuns who worked there, one of whom is the woman in the white shirt. And then the leadership of the community came to meet with us and tell us what they're doing in their community, which they're very excited about because they have their land back now, so now they can start to build things. A grandmother with her granddaughter, she's the head of the women's organization in that community. This was right there in that same community, was a group of community men digging a ditch because for the first time it was their own land they were on, and so they were going to start to improve it, which meant now they could build sewers. Mm-hmm. So as volunteers, unpaid, totally with their own resources, they were now out figuring out how to put sewers in so that their homes could have better sanitation. In this same community, I met these three girls walking back to school after lunch, and I chatted with them a bit. They're 16 years old, the same age as my daughter. And I said, "Do you live with your parents here?" And they all come out of one house, and they sort of hemmed and hawed, and then they said, "Well, all of our parents are dead." And I said, "Oh, so who do you live with?" And they said, "We live just the three of us together in this house." And they said, "We came from a different community that the hostels invaded and killed everybody, and we were left, and this community took us in." And their story is a mixed blessing, because the sort of bitterness and sadness of their life, that's their kitchen, that's everything in their kitchen. What you see is what you get there. And then they have one other room, and it has one single bed in it, and they had just done their laundry, so all their laundry was out. They have two pairs of underpants, one skirt, one shirt. And I think that's all. But that, I could see everything they owned laid out on the bed. But they said, "We are very fortunate because this community took us as their own, built us this house, this mud house, and raised the money so that we can buy school uniforms, which means we can go to school, and we are going to study hard and stay in school." And that seemed to be their total focus. So I thought, wow, that's incredible. They were such nice girls, and they were so proud to show me their home. And I said, how do you get food? And they said, sometimes the neighbors offer us food, and sometimes we don't have food. But this is that community where they have their own land. And when you have your own land, it seems like you're so empowered. It seems like it makes such a difference to the people there. They have their own land, then they'll take in anybody, they'll help anybody, they'll build sewers, they'll do everything just because they have their own land. This is the day that those of you who were in Vespers, when I did Vespers, that I talked about. When we got there in the morning, there were those rocks blocking the road. We couldn't drive in because they were worried about violence and they didn't want anyone to drive in without knowing who they were, and having the guys standing there doing guy talk, talking about whether it was safe or not for us to go in. So we waited, and eventually they let us in. Then we saw these two funerals. Those were all people attending the funerals in this township. And this was a place where, for those of you who weren't there on Monday, I will tell you, these people had all been displaced from their home 20 miles away into this township, forcibly removed. And they had been plunked down right in the middle of another group of people's grazing land, so here. So they were not welcome. And then the other group of people became Ankata Freedom Party, and these people were all ANC. And so there's some continuing violence and hostility between the two peoples, although they all live in the same community and they all have the same historical heritage. They're all Zulus. And there had been a shootout just a couple days before, and two people, a boy and a man, in this side of town had been killed, and a warlord in the other side of town had been killed. So we were there on the day of the funerals of all these people. And the kind of ugliness in their life, and the bitterness, and the fear. While we were there, an army police car drove up, and everybody ran and said there's going to be shooting and violence, because when the police arrived, there was always violence. But then they saw us, the North Americans, the police did, and so then they backed off and calmed down. There's the ANC flag. You can see the yellow bottom of it, at least. And they're dancing the toy toy and coming down the street, and people are grieving loudly and shrieking and showing their sadness. And the kids, of course, are having a wonderful time dancing. The bodies were inside the homes, but the mourners sat in front of the homes and prayed and talked. And then the bodies were taken away in trucks to a distant cemetery because they couldn't be buried in the cemetery in their own town that they would ordinarily have carried the bodies to, because it was on the Ankata side of town and everyone would be terrified to go there. They would be murdered if they would be shot if they went over there. So then we went by the cemetery. Every cemetery we went by had raw, fresh graves, dozens of them. I always kept thinking, why doesn't the grass grow in the graves in the cemetery? And then I realized they're all new graves. And our host that day was a school principal who lived in that town, and he desperately wanted to see his mother's grave. So he had us stop by the cemetery. He was lying on the floor of our van to hide from the Ankata people. And he peeked up over the window to see his mother's grave, and tears streamed down his face as he looked at it, and then he said, okay, drive on. He hadn't seen it for 2.5 years because he couldn't walk the 4 blocks, or 8 blocks, or whatever it was, to that side of town. And here we are with the enemy. These are the Ankata Freedom Party Zulus, and boy, were they scary. I mean, he does have a spear and a shield. But their houses were the same, their gardens were the same. They were, when we stopped and wanted to talk to them, these women would not talk to us until we all held hands in a circle and prayed for peace. And I thought, now, something is wrong here. Something's wrong with this picture. You know, these were the people we were supposed to be the most terrified of, and here we were holding hands with them praying for peace. But they were, it was just women and children there, because the person who had been killed in the previous violence was being buried, and all the men folk were off burying that person because it was a warlord. Then we went to the valley they had all come from originally, which is the valley. And several other people who had been raised there came to talk to us about life before and their hopes for the future. That was all that was left of a huge college that had been on this property, but there were lots of foundations. You can even see some of the foundations of various buildings. But we walked all in through here, and there were the army had completely knocked down this college, and then had knocked down their grammar school, two grammar schools, a high school, all their homes, the community center, everything, stores, wiped out the community about 20 years earlier. And moved, forcibly removed these people to the place where you saw the pictures of the funeral. It was a lovely, lovely place here. And our headmaster friend told me that this tree was in the front yard of his parents' home when he was a child growing up, and that he, in fact, was going to build right back there. When he, because he's going to move back now, because they've gotten, the courts have overturned this decision, and this land has been returned to the Zulu people, or to this group of the Zulus. And they don't do it in parcels, so they don't, everybody doesn't get their own separate little parcel, but they do it in a big, the land goes back to the tribe, and then everyone together decides who lives where. Then as I was sitting on this hillside, we had a picnic that was getting to be evening, and we heard music coming up from these woods. And so the other, there was a musician in our group too, and he and I wandered down through the woods. And we had seen people arriving all afternoon, coming on horseback across the land and walking, and just many people walking in. And they would all stop down in this house, do something, and then walk off this way into the woods. And then we heard the singing, and it was just incredibly transporting, beautiful singing, you know, in the complex harmonies and just beautiful in those strong bass voices. Oh. So we stood in the woods for a long time. Finally, we got curious, and we went closer and saw that it was a funeral. There was a cemetery there. So it was our fourth funeral of the day. But we found out that it was a man who had been raised here and now has moved back here, an old man, died of old age, natural death. His friends and family around him, people had come knowing he was dying and said goodbye to him. For a while, there were lots of chairs set up out here, and they had part of the service here, and then they all moved over there. So it felt like this death was, at the end of this day of looking at violence, was the death that was supposed to be. This is how we're supposed to die. People would walk back over here, wash their hands to leave death behind, and then walk back out across the property to go home. And I found it to be both sad and very promising to have this image left at the end of the day of hope, that in fact all this violence and terrible things that were happening did not mean that this scene didn't happen, that in fact this scene also had validity and was true and gave us a hope for the future. Then the next morning we went to the beach at Durban at 6 in the morning, and to see some Pentecostals having worship service at the beach. And some of them are there, and they did great. The pastor would wrestle with various members of each group and then dunk them forcibly, sort of like that, any number of times, sometimes 9 times, sometimes 7, sometimes 12. We couldn't figure out the pattern. So then we made friends with some of them and asked questions. Oh, they also put interesting crosses and things up in the sand. We asked questions. It turns out that we thought this was baptism. And they said, oh no, this is not baptism. We were all baptized long ago. This is a renewal and a cleansing of our spirit. And it helps us to deal with our sins. If we can bring them to consciousness, confess them, and then for each major sin, we're dunked in the water. And they said, it is also, every so often, our spirits begin to long to meet the spirits of the water people. So, that seemed pretty beautiful to me. And it turns out that one dunking can cleanse you from the sin of having killed someone. And since they all kill people, I mean, a lot of people are being killed, and they are in these war scenes all the time. They find that that weighs very heavy on their spirits, and that one of the ways that they can deal with that is through this kind of a situation. And to me, it seemed like it made a lot of sense. Then they would pray, and they would sing, and it was really quite an interesting morning. That was their, the group that we made the most friends with that was doing this, and our group intermingled here. See if you can guess who's who.
Are the white people missionaries?
Now, the white people were part of my group that I was traveling with. And then I was also traveling with this man who was a vice president of Tuskegee, and this man who was a community organizer in Michigan. And otherwise, the blacks there are from Africa. Then we spent a day going up into KwaZulu, which is one of the Zulu lands that is all Inkatha. So here we were really going into Inkatha land many miles, and it was, you know, if the Inkatha people knew that we were all ANC supporters, would they kill us? You know, it felt sort of scary to do it. It was beautiful, and it was very, most of these are white owned. No, that's not true. They're not white owned. These are all Zulu lands owned by Zulu people and farmed by Zulu people. And it was just incredibly beautiful. There were kraals, which are sort of farm, K-R-A-A-L is the word for farm there, but they have these circular homes with thatched roofs. And we found many photo opportunities because it was so lovely. And then we were going, it was a Sunday, and we were going to a place, to a town right in the heart of KwaZulu, and to meet with the community leaders. So we got to church, we got to this town and went to the church, and everybody was in the church. This entire church was jammed with people. And so we sort of snuck in and sat in the back and listened to the music, and it was beautiful. And then the service ended, and somebody got up in front, and they brought benches up in front, and they said, "Will our North American visitors please come up in front?" And we were all sort of, all right, I guess. So we went up there, and somebody stood up and made a speech and said, "We understand that you've come to meet with community leaders. We do not want you to meet with our leaders only. We have decided that you will meet with the entire community. Now, what would you like to know?" So the 10 of us sat there in the front of this jammed full church, and the first person to ask a question in our group was a woman, a black woman doctor from Boston, and she said, "Tell us about some of the health problems in your community." And pandemonium broke loose in this church, just people talking to each other back and forth, completely ignoring us, much discussion, and about 5 minutes later, somebody stood up and said, "We cannot answer that question." And we sort of looked back and forth at each other and thought, "Oh, what are we going to do now?" And finally, an old man stood up and said, "I'm an old man." And then there was a murmuring through the church. And then he said, "And because I am an old man, I'm going to tell you the truth." And then there was immediately somebody else popped up and said, "Don't do that. You'll be sorry. Don't do it." And he said, "No, I'm going to tell them the truth because I'm an old man, and it doesn't matter if I should lose my life." And I, you know, this man is going to tell us the truth and lose his life. He said, "If we were to answer your question, we would have to criticize our government. And if we criticize our government, we are in big trouble. So we cannot answer your question because the answer to it requires being critical of our government." Now, the Zulu government is hand in hand with the whites there. The Zulus have sold out compared to everybody else. And so that the Inkatha Freedom Party, which is the Zulu people, are friends with the dominant white power structure. But, interestingly enough, they get the lowest percentage of funds for things like healthcare and education and stuff like that of any of the tribes in Africa, in South Africa. So their selling out hasn't done them a damn bit of good because they don't get anything for it. But they were all terrified to speak to us. We learned then that the reason the entire community was going to meet with us instead of just the leadership was so that no one would think that any secrets were being told to these North Americans. They didn't want to have any sense that there was something sneaky going on, or, you know, they're terrified that their government will catch them doing something critical of the government or not kosher. So then, once that was settled, then we learned that we should ask questions of matters of fact or questions that did not imply criticism of the government. So our doctor friend said, "Do you have a hospital?" And then they could answer that question. And then we asked other sort of factual questions. when we introduced ourselves, we each told what our interests were, and I introduced myself and said I was interested in women and women's organizations, and all the women in the congregation went, so I got to ask questions about the women's organization, and then, of course, they had very difficult stories to tell about starvation and about their children not having enough strength to even walk to school because they didn't have enough food and because they didn't have health care. And, you know, so the stories came out that their quality of life was not good. But we had to get at the stories in different ways. Then once it was established that nothing illegal or sneaky was going on, then people drifted out of church and left us with just the leaders, who were these people. And at the end of our time together, the woman in the white hat is the oldest woman in the whole town. And she was called up to give a speech. We couldn't end the meeting until she had sort of given her views on what had happened. So the men talked and everybody talked, and then Mrs. whatever her name is was asked to come up, and she gave a talk sort of summarizing what had been said and making recommendations for the future and asking for our help and stuff like that. So she was, there she is again. She was a very articulate and strong and powerful matriarch of that whole community. I had brought a little money from my women's organization in Chicago to give somewhere in South Africa, and I made a little speech to her at the end saying, you know, out here afterwards, saying, my women's organization has asked me to give some money to a women's organization in Chicago. I mean, in Africa, would you please do me the honor of accepting this money? And they agreed that they would. And so we had a nice connection. Those were the Lutheran missionaries in that community, the Nelsons. And there was another cemetery on the way out of there. Oh dear. Oh, we're now at Cape Town, and we're going down to the Cape, and there are some monkeys beside the road. It's sort of hard to see them, I guess. But
so is there fighting going on in that township or that area that you were in?
Yeah, there was. And
were there ANC people there, or they were all in Kata? Or?
There were not ANC people there. They were all in Kata, but they talked of fighting. So there must have been. I don't know how, where the white fighting came from, but that was the town. Well, I don't know why there was fighting there, but there was, because they talked about the effects of it. But I think more death and terrible things happened there because of starvation. They just didn't have food. So they talked about the effect of only eating corn on children's bones, and, you know, how just only corn is not enough, or sugar cane and corn. So I think we will quickly go by Cape Town. Cape Town is where the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean come together. It's really quite spectacular, but it's probably not what we want to look at now. That's all along the Cape Town. That's right at the point of the Cape. Then we went and visited in Cape Town with Father Basil, who is this man who had led a resistance 20 years earlier or so, 15 years earlier, to the government completely wiping out District 6, which is one huge district of Cape Town. And that's the principal of the school, along with Father Basil. District 6, that's his church, that's Table Mountain behind it. District 6 is a region that is very high property values. The ocean is out here, and you can see all of this land here would be prime land for building on homes and stuff. I mean, it crosses the highway and goes on up here. It's all close to downtown. You can have a good view. It's beautiful. So the government decided they wanted it and bulldozed, and it had really old, nice housing on it, and they bulldozed the whole thing. So they completely emptied out District 6, which was a colored district, mixed blood, neither black nor white. And Father Basil led the charge to resist this happening. And one of the things they did was paint this mural on the church, which is, I have notes on every square of it all the way around, but it's got it's all the images of the battle to keep District 6 from being taken from the people. And they lost the immediate battle because all the housing was bulldozed and they were all moved away to a terrible place on the sand flats. But once again, it has now been overturned in the courts, and now the people from there, 15 years later, can move back. And the great success that they had was that they didn't allow anything else to get built on the land. The people kept up the resistance to such an intense pitch that nobody dared build on the land all this time. So it's vacant except for that housing which was built, which is all union housing, and the people decided it was okay to build housing for working people. So they did really succeed in keeping their old neighborhood free of new building, so that now when they finally have won in the courts, they can begin to move back. And now they're having big community discussions out on the sand flats about who's going to move back and how they're going to decide and how it's going to get funded. And Father Basil is trying to raise money and build housing. And so it was a real success story, actually, and a huge battle. We're sitting around in the courtyard of the church there on the seven steps. There were seven stone steps right in the middle of District 6 that was sort of the heart of the community, where people would sit and talk or meet or pass on the way to market or all that stuff. And Basil saved them because of the sort of symbolic importance of them. And so that the seven stone stairs are going to be put back into whatever is rebuilt now on that land. This is where they were moved to from there. These people were all fisher people, and they mostly made their living by fishing. And they were moved into a place that was miles from the water, they couldn't fish, and into this incredibly depressing housing. And then not only did that do that, but there wasn't enough room for them in this housing, so then there had to be squatter stuff all in the backyards of all these ugly buildings. So the people there now are bitter, and they fight, and there's misery and ugliness among them. It's just the most ugly place that you can imagine. But there are lots of churches and mosques. See the mosque tower there. And this was the woman in the stripes. Her name is Carol Jackson, and she's the head community organizer for that community. She's trying to organize people to get ready to go back to District 6 and try to keep the people from killing each other. And she's struggling to educate women so that women have options in that community. And she's just got an absolutely thankless job because the living conditions are so awful there. But people love her, and she's really succeeding. She's getting some stuff together. She was a very powerful woman. And that is in the community organization that we met and talked about the various issues in the community. That was a group of homeless colored people there who told us their stories and talked about how hopeless it all seems from their point of view. That was a street gang in that community. And that street gang, those boys, we stopped and talked, they told us their stories. One of them was, they were all visibly damaged from fighting, or, you know, this guy had total burns in here. One of them was on a cane or a crutch there. They were just battered kids, and they did all these hand signs, you know, insignias of like street gangs do in Chicago. And we said, "Who is your enemy?" And they pointed just across this flat land to another building exactly like this and said, "They're our enemy." You know, and they just are killing each other. I mean, these kids who are probably cousins, because it's such an awful place to live. The living conditions are so awful. And removing people's roots and transplanting them just seems to be so bad for people. That was a creche in that community. A creche is what they call daycare centers. I thought those kids were so adorable that I couldn't resist taking their picture. They're all taking a, they're not dead, they're taking a nap. Then the last thing I'm going to tell you about South Africa before I quickly move on to Namibia is we went to a conference. Tom and I, the rest of the group left, and Tom went and I stayed a few extra days in Johannesburg. Then we went to a conference hosted by the ANC for all their international supporters that have been their supporters in the last 20 years, and that includes Holden Village. People who've prayed for South Africa, people who've shined the public light of scrutiny on apartheid, people internationally all over the world who have said, apartheid is not okay. This is not something we can accept and look away from. So all the work that people have been doing, you know, trying to get their friends not to buy Krugerrands, or all the ways we've organized to support South Africa, this was the first time the ANC had been able to host a conference on their own land in Africa to say thank you. So there were 80 nations there. We had, you know, earphones with many different languages you could choose from. In the press, it was clear that Mandela was ill and was forbidden to leave his bed for 3 weeks. He was suffering from exhaustion. So he was supposed to be the keynote speaker, but he couldn't come because of the exhaustion. And so all the others, Oliver Tambo, and, you know, all the sort of big shots in the ANC spoke. And the people, it was a wonderful, wonderful gathering of terrific people. Evidently, I don't have a... Yeah, there. But on the second morning, in came Mandela. You know, we were in the middle of business, and some guy in a suit was lecturing, and it was sort of business as usual, and all of a sudden this hush swept over this room with, you know, about several thousand people in it. And then some African women started doing a dance and singing a song, and Mandela came in wearing a Serafina t-shirt and just a pair of chinos, you know, casual pants. And he walked very slowly up onto the platform, and it was just electrifying. Everybody was so thrilled to see him. And he went to the microphone and said, "You all kept me alive all those years. I was in Robben Island digging, you know, chopping." He was working in a stone pit, digging out stones. "And all the time that you would not let the government of South Africa fall into a condition of normalcy and say, this is okay, we're going to ignore it, we're going to accept it. I couldn't let all of our international supporters come to this country and not come myself and say thank you." And he gave quite a long speech, which I intended to take notes on, but I was crying, so I couldn't. He was so wonderful. He's an electrifying speaker. And then there was much sort of a love fest, you know, people bringing him gifts and lots of hugging and stuff. And then finally the crowd started to chant, "Go home to bed, go home to bed," you know. Because everybody just loved him so much, and he was clearly so weak. And so it was a wonderful, wonderful occasion. I felt so honored to be there. And it just made you think, you know, I'm going to pray that this man will live long enough to become president there, and I'm worried that he won't. But it was pretty spectacular to see him. Then we flew from there to Windhoek, Namibia. And this is our first afternoon in Windhoek. This is a country, as I told you, that is now liberated from apartheid. And in fact, it's now been 3 years since they've been liberated from it. And we noticed a number of changes immediately. One is that the government is busy building housing for people. So these are new houses that are being put up. And they're in contrast with the old ones, you know, and here's what they had lived in, and then they're building these. And they're all alike, and, you know, maybe you wouldn't want to live in them, but boy, they look pretty good to those folks. And there's water, there's electricity, they're electrifying. So the government seems to be really focused on trying to come through for people in some ways. Now I suspect that's an outdoor bathroom. You know, it's not heaven, but it's a lot better than it could be. So building housing is one of the things that the government is really working on. And also, Namibia is the fifth most sparsely populated country in the world. When the white dominant religions divided up Africa, the Lutherans got Namibia, so it's our country, and it's over 50% of the population in Namibia is Lutheran, but it's very sparsely populated, and so even in squatter communities where it's all informal housing, it's not jammed together, it's much more, there's more space for stuff, it's more spread out. The government is supporting developing things like the Namibia Women's Center, which was a wonderful, wonderful place in Windhoek that's huge. It offers classes, it offers childcare, it offers economic development stuff so that people can learn how to make money on their own. It offers support for battered women and a course in how to reduce violence, personal violence in your life, and that, you know, sort of consciousness raising around violence and peace. This is part of that Women's Center. It was just, you know, it's a beautiful, big facility supporting women's issues. I couldn't believe it. But the government believes that, that they have to work on these issues, so they provide them a space. There's lots of these daycare centers around, so, and the children looked well and healthy and well cared for. This, and this creche, the kids sang to us, and the, that was the teacher there. And she, they sang the Namibian National Anthem, which is incredibly badly written, hard to sing, complex, long piece. But everybody's so glad to have a national anthem in a country that everybody can sing it. Just wish they'd gotten someone who had some more ability to write it better. But anyhow, they know it. The kids knew it. Lots of community organizations like SWAPO there, where it's okay to be advocating for dignity, peace, justice, for the good things in life. It, you know, it's just you don't have to hide when you're doing political work. This is Kamita.
Zephaniah.
Zephaniah Kamita. He's been at Holden Village. He is the person that everyone there refers to as the Martin Luther King Jr. of Namibia. He's he talked to our, he's an absolutely profoundly wise and wonderful man. He's a Lutheran pastor. He's black, but he's albino, so he doesn't, he, you can see how he looks. Gracious, smart, funny, but profoundly religious and profoundly a spiritual person and wise, just so wise. He was just riveting to listen to. And he talked about, he's a Lutheran pastor. He was drafted to be in the parliament of the new government, and sort of against his thinking even that he would be a politician, he became a member of parliament, and his position now is, he's the, let's see if I can find it, deputy speaker of parliament. So so he's really the, he's the guy that runs all the meetings in parliament, and he's, he talked about his skills as a Lutheran pastor serving well in that capacity because he could make peace among people and stuff. But he talked so, in such an anguished way, about the importance of reconciliation. He said as a pastor he always used to preach reconciliation and think reconciliation was sort of an important thing. But now he says, I have to be reconciled with people that I hate and people that I have fought and people that have hurt me and hurt my people. And he said that's, it's really a cross to bear. But he talked about success stories and his own feelings about reconciliation and how he is getting somewhere dealing with his feelings about that. So if you can hear Kamita tapes there in the library here, he's just such a wonderful man. That's a Zulu king, I mean, not a Zulu king, Harari king. This is a Harari family. They're having a terrible drought in Namibia, and this family has been destroyed. This entire tribe has been destroyed by the drought. The menfolk have all gone off years ago to the city to try to find work. They couldn't find work in the city, but they all drink, and so now all the men are gone and are drunk. And the women are left here in depression with no food. They've been, they can't grow corn even in the riverbed for 4 years now, so they have no corn. All they eat is goat. They eat goat bones, goat soup, goat meat, goat milk, goat cheese, and that's all they have to eat. They don't have corn. They don't have anything. That's their home. The drought has been just devastating to the people of Namibia, and this one family that we spent quite a lot of time with. In the midst of all the drought, of course, it keeps my eye, kept seeing beautiful things, like they make their own pots, and they're beautiful. That's their bathroom. This is another family in Namibia that we spent time with. The woman there is the matriarch. She's a goat herd and a potter and a weaver, and she runs this very complicated kraal. She allowed us into almost all the some of her weaving. She and I got to be good friends. She's a real wonderful person. She allowed us into all the rooms of her kraal, which is a great honor. Ordinarily, you just get to be in the outside few rooms. So I got to see, you know, the various spaces. That's where they keep the dried meat. That was their sleeping space. That's where if they'd had corn, they would have ground it into cornmeal for cooking, but they don't have any.